class of pupils from one of the Manchester Catholic churches, a Catholic school, and they were evacuated to Ramsbottom. And that affected you, you know, why were they coming to Ramsbottom from St. Bridget's in Manchester? But they stayed for so long and then gradually went back.
They were boarded in the town, were they?
They were boarded with various people within the town, the parish.
As children, how did the children mix with the evacuees? How did you get on with
them? As far as I remember, okay. I made friends with one of the lads who came, Tony O'Grady. I can still remember his name. I wouldn't know him if I saw him, but I still remember his name. Yeah, I think they mixed okay.
You said there was a classroom for them. Were they kept as a group in their own classroom?
Yeah, one of the teachers came with them. And we had a spare classroom at the school at that time, and they used that.
So tell me a little bit about the school, about St. Joseph's. What was it like?
It was built, the school I went to was built about 1928, so it was fairly modern in 1940. It was an all-age school, unless you got a scholarship or an entrance to a technical college. You stayed at that school until you left school at 14. And it was a bit rough at times in those days. We all wore clogs. And one lad found it was easy to punce, as we used to say.
What's that?
Or the teacher, kick him with your clogs. I suppose it was a little bit rough. But then it was a working class school.
So how many classrooms were there?
Six. I seem to remember. Six in the what we call the upper school. In a way, there were two schools. There was an infant's school with its own head teacher. And in there were two classes and two teachers. And then you moved up to the big school, as you called it. Where there were six rooms and three teachers until the lady came from Manchester. And then when she left, they were still in three. So you had, I suppose, two classes in one room. This is why we had a spare room.
So how many pupils would there be in the class then, if two classes to a teacher?
Well, there'd certainly be over 30. But it wasn't a big school, and it's a bigger school now. The school still exists as a primary, and it's a bigger school because of all the development that's taken place in Ramsbottom over the last few years.
So what were the classrooms like?
It was one of the last schools that the Education Authority, we came under Lancashire, of course, allowed with partitions that you could push back. There was, as I said, I think there were six classrooms. Two classrooms were called the big, the hall, we called it. And you could push all the partitions back and make the school into one big room, which could be used for dances and social events and so on. And this was very useful to a parish.
Were these sort of floor-to-ceiling partitions, or more like a screen?
Oh, floor-to-ceiling, yeah. Once the partitions were made into classrooms, floor-to-ceiling, yeah.
So in each classroom there would be what?
Oh, the blackboard, of course. And your the desks that you lifted up, and you had ink in the ink pot and so on. And cupboards for the teacher. Never thought there was much of a staff room for teachers at that time, at their own classroom.
So that your desk, would you have an individual desk, or would you share a desk with another?
There'd be two desks, but you'd have your own part of the other two that were together.
So what about the seats? Were they attached to the desk?
Yeah, you pull the seats down.
Yes, you pull them.
Your seats could push up or pull down like you have in the cinema, you know, something like that. Wooden, of course.
Well, that would be to allow you to get in?
Get in and out, yeah.
And the blackboard, was this fixed to the wall, or would it be freestanding?
The freestanding. I mean, I'm going back now over 60 years. Yeah, because if it was fixed to the partition, you wouldn't be able to push the partition back.
Was it boys and girls?
Oh, yes.
And were the classes were actually mixed as well, were they?
Yes.
So what was discipline like?
Strict. Yes, it was strict. But then, so were all schools at that time, in places like Ramsbottom. You did as you were told, and we had corporal punishment.
Who would administer that?
The head teacher had a strap, actually, but he did this. He had his own class that he dealt with the more serious cases from the other classes if it was necessary. And then another male teacher, and he had a pointer. And if you didn't answer his questions, you got it on the hand with his pointer. And one of the lady teachers had a habit of hitting children across the face. And she had some rather large rings on her fingers.
Well, what would happen if you went home and told, well, would you tell your parents that you'd been punished at school?
Well, they'd want to know why. They would not be all that keen on going up to the school. Some would. They thought that it was unfair that their child had been chastised in that way. Yeah.
Were you aware, going to school, sort of as a boy of, I mean, you'd only be sort of seven, yeah. Were you aware of the war going on around you, so to speak?
Oh, yes. Yes, with a couple of landmines dropped at Stubbins, which wasn't all that far from where I lived. And later on, when the doodle books, as we call them, came over, dropped one dropped in Tottington, which is a different village. And that quite a few people were killed. And we knew it because we went to the cinema and British Movie Tour News and all the rest of it taught us how wicked the Germans were. And never trust them, and Hitler was a pig and all this kind of thing. So yes, we knew there was a war on.
So actually in school, was it brought home to you as children actually in school?
Yes. Every so often, the government would have a scheme to try and get people to invest or buy savings certificates, whatever, and you'd have a war weapons week or something like an aeroplane week. And during that week, they'd have one of these barometers. You remember, our target was so much, and and on the Friday of that week, all the schools marched from their premises down to the marketplace, where one of the teachers from one of the schools, Mr. Haslam, used to conduct all the kids in singing Land of Hope and Glory and British Grenadier and so on. And we'd have walked from our own school with one of the big boys, he would be about 13, carrying the Union Jack in front. So, yes, we knew that there was a war going on.
This was just to collect?
This was to get people in to save, to buy savings tickets, so that you're helping the war effort, you see. I think that happened in most towns.
What about sort of air raid precautions? What would happen? Were you taught or shown anything there in school?
Yes, well, first of all, you'd got to take your gas mask. If you didn't, you got the cane, because this was the law. It's, as far as I can remember, it was the law. You had to take your gas mask. Up and down the town, there were shelters built. I don't remember if there was not many underground shelters. There were reinforced brick. And so we would have practices of going into a shelter. I don't know whether this is going back a little bit to when I lived in Haywood. When war was declared, they closed all the schools. And, well, this was marvellous, of course. But they decided that even though they're not allowed to run the school, and have a lot of children in one room, excuse me. People in the parish at Haywood, who had a large house, would allow the house to be used by a teacher and so many pupils in the morning or an afternoon. And I don't know if you've ever seen Cranelli's ice cream. Well, they were in Haywood, part of our family, and there's a large house, and I had to go there. They were called Longinotti, actually, but it was known as Cranelli's ice cream. And I went there for so many weeks or whatever, until they decided we could open up the schools again. So, and we used to laugh because the boys there, the two sons of Mrs. Longinotti, used to refer to us as Mama. We thought this was very sissy. We never called our mothers mama. But that was a sad case because Mr. Longinotti had never naturalised. He'd come over from Italy and married a Miss Granelli, but he'd never taken British citizenship, and he was arrested when the Italians, of course, declared war, and he was arrested and taken, and was on the Arandora Star, which was taking aliens to Canada, but was sunk by the Germans off the coast of Ireland. He was, she never saw him again, his wife, and he was just turned down. Yes, but that was the, that was part of the war attack, I remember, going to Cranelli's or Mrs. Longinotti's house.
You mentioned the cinema a moment or two ago. How else would you spend your free time as a child in this area?
There were various youth clubs. Most of the churches had youth clubs, and of course the Boy Scouts and so on. You'd play out. If you hadn't got the money to go to the pictures, you'd play out in the street or a field or whatever.
What would you play out?
Where I lived, there was a saltworks, and a lot of empty barrels and so on were stored there. We used to play in those, make dens. Recently I did a rallio or tip-lags, you know, things that horrible children shouldn't do, knocking on people's doors and running away, you know, this is a terrible thing. But yeah, you played out until your mother decided it was time for bed, and then she would come and find you, and that was it. But with two cinemas, and they changed films halfway through the week, so you could go four times, actually, if your parents would allow you during the week, but we never could.
You remember how much it cost you for going?
If we went on a Saturday, it was sixpence, I think. I think it was ninepence if you went in the evening. In not the best seats, I think the best seats were the more expensive seats at the back.
So for your sixpence, what sort of seats were you sitting on?
Fairly comfortable. Oh yeah, they weren't bad cinemas. What they were like originally, I don't know, but in the 1940s, they weren't so bad.
So can you remember anything that you used to go and see? What would they be showing on a Saturday, say, for the children's... This would be the children's matinee, would it?
This was the children's matinee. There would be a cowboy. It was always a Western. Roy Rogers or someone like that. And there would be a serial, just so that you could go every week, you see. And I can remember one called Dick Winslow of the Navy. I think it was an American one. So yes, you'd have you wouldn't have anything sloppy, as the lads would say. It didn't have to be an adventure thing, a cowboy. And the cowboys always had to win. The Indians weren't allowed to win, the cowboys had to win. Yeah, and the cinema would be full. We queued up to get in. And the noise. All those kids in the cinema. Banging their feet if it was late at starting or something like that.
Well, would there be sort of any aim at discipline in the cinema from the cinema owner or the manager?
There was a lady who used to... If we banged... When Dick Winslow of the Navy came on, the signature tune, everyone... Then bang my feet, you see, in time with it. And this woman would come on the stage and tell us not to stop it, you know. She'd shout at us. So, yes, there was a bit of... You didn't perhaps need as much discipline in those days. You got that at home anyway and at school. So, you didn't rip up the seats or anything like that. We couldn't have done too young.
So, during the wartime, when you were growing up, what were Christmases like? What would happen at Christmas time?
Oh, we'd always go to Mass, of course. Some, as we got older, we would go to the midnight Mass, but generally speaking, it would be Mass on Christmas Day. My mother was quite a good cook, and she could manage to give us a decent meal, although my father didn't like white meat, so we never had chicken or anything like that, or turkey. But then not many of them would have a turkey during the war. I mean, I find quite amazing that these one of the cheapest cuts of meat now is chicken. Now that was a luxury when I was a kid, was chicken. But my father and my sister didn't like chicken, so we didn't have it. We couldn't have special ones. And we had toys. We believed in Father Christmas, and we had toys bought us that they could in the, you know, there were certain things you could get in the shops during the war.
Were you aware of the rationing and the problems with the rationing?
Oh, yes. Yes. Well, I can remember, yes, you had to register as a shop, and you bought your groceries from that shop and handed in your ration book.
What about your sweet rationing? Because as a child, obviously, it plays quite an important part.
Yeah, we were only allowed to have what the government said. You see, a lot of kids had grandparents who would give them their sweet ration. Well, we didn't get that. Only one of my cousins somehow managed to get grandfather. My grandmother had died by this time, and he always got the sweets from granddad. It didn't matter, really. We weren't all that bothered.
Can you remember what you were allowed, what you could get?
I can't remember that. We could get chocolate. That was part of the ration, but what the actual allowance was.
So how long did you remain at St. Joseph?
Till I was 11, 1944.
And what happened then?
I took the Lancashire County Council scholarship exam. This, of course, was replaced later by the 11 plus, wasn't it? Not everybody was entered for the scholarship. I think there were five of us that particular year, 1944, from St. Joseph's. And on a Saturday morning, we had to go to St. Paul's School, another school in Ramsbottom. All the kids who were taking the scholarship had to go there that Saturday morning. And I was fortunate enough to get a scholarship.
Were your parents approached with permission to allow you to sit for the exam, or was it a school decision?
It was a school decision, I think. Yeah, I can't remember my parents. Well, they knew I was taking it. I can't remember that they'd been asked to go to the school and need permission.
So what format did the exam take?
It was more or less the 3 hours, I think. And it's a fair distance. I seem to remember, we were all given a new ruler and a new pen. Steel pens in those days, of course, no biros. And I think it was mainly mathematics and English.
So you were told that you'd passed?
Yeah.
So which school were you sent to?
I was sent to Thornley Salesian College in Bolton.
Again, was this the school that was offered to you, or would your parents have had a choice which school you went to?
I could have gone to De La Salle in Salford, but Bolton was more convenient, and I'd already passed the entrance exam for Thornley and De La Salle. It would have meant my parents having to pay. They needed a scholarship, and if I'd failed the scholarship for Lancashire County, I would have had to leave school at 14 and get myself a job.
So when you started in Bolton in 1944, yeah, was there any sort of problem in equipping yourself with the uniform and what else you needed?
There was a school uniform, but because of the war, they only made wearing a cap compulsory. The blazers came later because of clothing coupons and one thing and another. So yes, I had to wear a cap, a school cap, and it was brown, cut out. And that's been all the work until later on, my mum's then decided I had to buy a blazer.
Had you to provide anything else for school when you got to Bolton?
No, I had a satchel. They bought a satchel, which wasn't completely leather because you couldn't get that in the war either. So No, they provided books and they didn't have to provide those.
So how would you go about travelling?
I used to walk it a fair distance from where I lived to the, what we call the marketplace in Ransomsden. Catch a bus to Bolton and catch another bus from Bolton Centre, Nassley Bridge, or a Dunscar bus that took us fairly near the school, but it was about a 10-minute walk from the school. So, yeah, it took us some time to get there and to get home.
So what time would you be setting off then in the morning?
Well, we started at 9 o'clock, didn't we? We'd have to be leaving home at something to 8 or something like that. I would think, looking back. And about a 20-minute walk from where I lived to the town centre. And then a couple of buses get to school.
What happened in Ramsbottom at the end of the war? What sort of celebrations took place?
Mainly, oh, I can remember this thing. This is the end of the war in Europe. They'd gone to bed, and then there were bangs, drum, banging on a drum somebody, and everybody got up, and the war was over, and we went up to the centre. Town centre, a chap there had a shop, sold gramophone records, and he played records, and people were dancing. And that was the VE. And then we had street parties. They made potato pies. The ladies, they were allowed to use one of the chapel's kitchens to do this. And we had street parties. We didn't go to school.
Well, there, so I was thinking about still sticking with the wartime years. Were you aware of soldiers coming and going from Ramsbottom, the young men of the town?
Yes. I only learned later that Dirk Bogart was stationed in Ramsbottom during the war. At Stubbins, actually.
There was an army camp at Stubbins?
Yes, yeah. Dirk Bogart was there.
Did they come?
We didn't know the time.
Just as well.
Just as well.
Did the soldiers come down into the town?
Oh, yes.
See much of them?
Yeah, you'd see them. Yeah, and with the Home Guard, of course, as well as the Army and Air Force and so on.
Well, how would they make their presence known?
Well, the pubs did in a roaring trade, didn't they? They had the stuff to sell. They would do drill and things like that at the town centre. You knew they were there. Yeah, the lady next, the house next door to where I lived, she took in lodgers. One from the Polish Air Force and one I think was Czechoslovakian. Because of course we had people here from Poland.
So the soldiers weren't all based at the camp, they didn't all actually live up there?
These two that lived the lodge next door to us, of course, they were foreigners. Now whether, I think some of our own soldiers were debilitated in certain houses,
So how old were you when you left school?
17.
So when you were coming up to 17, did you receive any sort of career guidance or chats with what you were going to do as a career when you left school?
No. The headmaster thought I ought to try for university. And I got a good school certificate and then went into the lower sixth with the idea of hoping to go to university and become a history teacher. But after two terms, my mother was taken ill and I was told by my father that I had to leave school, start earning some money. So I left school, not knowing what I wanted to do. Well, yes, I wanted to be
a history teacher.
History teacher after university, but that was out.
Was there a reason why your father decided that you would have to earn some money?
I think it was the fact that I was the first in the family to go to a grammar school, and perhaps thought that was enough, you know. Having this idea of going to university and not earning and having to be kept. So that was it.
So at that time, if you had carried on and gone to university, would your father have had to have funded you, or would you still have been able to get...
I think I would have got grants, yeah, but I wouldn't have been earning. This was another thing. Oh yeah, thinking about the family income, I'm sure they would have got grants.
So you left at the age of 17, no idea at all what you were going to do.
No.
So what did you do?
Well, a friend of my mother's, her son had gone into a bank, and she thought that sounded very nice. So I applied for a job with the district bank, as it used to be called, and I had to go for an interview to Spring Gardens in Manchester, to the headquarters. And thank God I didn't get the job. I think there were four of us, and just one person was going to get a job. Well, maths was never my main subject. And I didn't get it, so that was all right. So then I was advised by someone, I've forgotten who, that there was a careers lady from Lancashire County, came to Ramsbottom once or twice a week. Youth employment in Protestant. And I went there to see this lady, and she said, look, a friend of mine is the chief librarian at Rawtenstall, and he has asked his committee if he can appoint an extra member of staff as a junior library assistant. Now, would you like to have a look round and see what it's like in a library? I mean, I knew I'd been a member of the library since I was six, but not behind the scenes. So I went along and saw Mr. Hunt, and he showed me round. And I thought, yeah, that'd be interesting. He said, but there's no guarantee I'm going to get this extra assistant. So if anything crops up in the meantime, you apply for it. And this is what happened. But he didn't get his extra assistant, and there was an advert in the Bury Times for Bury Library, and so I applied for that, and I got that. I'd taken an exam, very unusual, I'd got quite a good school certificate, but I'd still to take the corporation exam before I was allowed.
This was again on the 3 hours type of thing, was it?
A general knowledge one. General knowledge, mainly. So, I eventually got it and started work at Bury Library and did 38 years at Bury Library and 2 years at Burnley Library. I did 2 years at Burnley in the 1950s for a bit of promotion and extra money, £3 a week extra.
So when you started work at Bury, junior library assistant, what were your duties? What were you expected to do in that capacity?
Counter work, issuing and discharging the books, keeping books in order. One of my early jobs was dealing with the, what we used to call them, bespokes, reserved books, people reserving books. And it was, one of my jobs was to find the book and let the people know that the book was ready for them. Also dealing with requests from the North West Regional Library Service. And as I got. That was the beginning, keeping books in order.
We're well used now when you go to the library and a book's whistled in front of a computer and that's it. How would it be issued in those days?
Well, it was issued, every book had a card and every reader had a card, membership card. If you marry the two together, that's known as an issue. And you know then that the book is out to a certain person, and when it's due back, because it's kept in date order and then in numerical order in each date. So that it was known as the Brown system. of issuing books, and most libraries used it at that time.
So when a book came back, it was a question just going through all the cards?
And you found that, and if it had been reserved, there would be something tagged to it to say it was reserved, and you put it in a separate place, and let the people know what it was.
It must have been a fairly time-consuming business when a book came back.
Yes, certainly, different way it is now.
So when the books went out, I mean, would you keep all the cards and tickets to one side? Would they be sorted out later, or would they be done as you went along?
Depended how busy or how quiet you were. You would try to do them as you went along, but it just wasn't possible. So they were left until possibly the following morning, when you all had to be put in order.
So what hours were you working at that time when you first started?
It was 38, but it seemed longer because we did three evenings a week, including Saturdays.
So when would the library be open? What hours was it open?
The library was open 10 till 8, 10 in the morning till 8 at night. Now, 7:30 was when the lending library closed. At 8 o'clock is when the reference library closed. And that was Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, Friday and Saturday. Wednesday was half day, so you just worked till 1 o'clock if you were working Wednesdays. The junior staff, anyway.
So you'd be sort of doing almost a shift work sort of thing?
Yes, it was. You see, if you worked till 7 o'clock, you had between 5 and 6 for tea. So you worked working till 7 o'clock. It wasn't much longer than working until 5:30. And yeah, you were stuck there having your tea.
Can you remember what you were paid when you started?
Yeah, £2.19 a week. Better than nothing. But, £2.19 a week. And the lads were paid more than the girls for doing the same work.
How much more do you
remember? I can't remember that, but we were paid more than the girls at that time. It did change, thank goodness, but that the girls were getting the same.
Was that sort of, I mean, I know at that time that was fairly common, but was it sort of accepted within the library, or did you find there was a resentment from the girls on payday?
Not too much, I don't think, although they were glad when they did get equal pay.
Were you paid weekly or monthly?
We were paid weekly in cash. Every Friday afternoon, a taxi used to pull up outside the library, and some staff from the Treasury Department used to get out with a case and leave us all our wages, as they were, in brown envelopes, then off to another local authority department. Yes, it was cash week. At that time, it did change, of course.
Did you remain within the lending library, or did you go through to the reference section?
At the beginning? With no reference librarian, and they used to ring a bell in the reference library. Somebody who was on counter in the lending library used to have to go into ref, as we call it, and see if they could deal with it. If they couldn't, then it was passed to someone more senior. But we didn't have, at that time, we didn't have a reference library.
Well, how big was the library at that time?
Not too big. The building housed the art gallery and the library. Most of the rooms taken for the art gallery. Putting pictures on the walls takes up much more space than putting books on shelves. But originally, the lending library was closed access. People were not allowed to go to the books and browse and choose a book. There was a counter across, staff on one side, public on the other. And there was a catalogue of list of all the books with a number for each book. And then there was an indicator, as they called it, with all these numbers on. And if it was showing, you could take them out and turn them around and put them back in again. And if it was showing red, if it was showing red, the book was out. If it was showing blue, the book was in. And so you wrote it down, and the member of the staff had to go and find it for you. You handed this. This is before my time. But that meant you didn't need a lot of room in a lending library. You can have the books right up to the ceiling, because only the staff were going to use them. and nobody was allowed to browse. So you could have the book, the shelves closer together. So that changed in about 1910, I think. But it always meant that we never had sufficient room in the lending library, because it had been designed for a different kind of librarianship. So although it looks a big building, on the whole it isn't, because of that. The gallery is, the art gallery is, was always looked upon as the more important part. And it has a wonderful collection of paintings, very art galleries, one of the best collections of Victorian paintings in the north of England, really.
And, so how were the books actually catalogued then? Computer days?
A senior cataloguer, a senior girl or lad would be responsible for cataloguing and classification. We didn't have a qualified one at the beginning. It was a few years before we got a qualified librarian to do that. And you catalogued by the Anglo-American cataloguing rules. I still remember, I've got my own copy somewhere in this house. So that was the cataloguing.
Briefly, did it work?
The most important thing about a book is the author. So you catalogue under author's name. I don't know what they do these days, but because they've got computers and everything, but we catalogued under the author. And on the catalogue card, you had to put the classification number, because that's how the books were shelved, particularly the non-fiction books. Fiction books were shelved in alphabetical order of author. Non-fiction books were shelved according to a classification scheme. And at Bury, we used an unusual classification scheme. It had been invented in 1906 by a man called James Duff Brown, and it was known as the Brown Subject Classification Scheme. It was British. Now, the most popular one, of course, is the Dewey Decimal Classification Scheme. That's American. Now, why in 1906 they decided to have a British scheme, I don't know. Perhaps it was a bit sort of patriotism, I don't know. It was a good scheme in many ways, but it was a very unusual scheme. There was no such thing as a generalia class that you get in Dewey. And I mean, it's a long time since I used this now, because we changed in the 1950s, 60s, 1960s. And he had some funny ideas that every technology is based upon, I can't go into that. It was such an unusual scheme that there's no such thing as a music class, because music is really sound. So it was put with books on technology of sound. So it was an unusual scheme. In some ways it was better than Dewey, but by the time I was using it, there were only three libraries in the north of England using it. That's Bury, Rochdale, and I think it was Littleborough. Or was it Oswald Twissell? It was used in one or two libraries in the south, but everybody else used Dewey. So we changed over to Dewey, which is a lousy scheme, but everybody uses it.
That must have created a lot of problems when you changed over.
Oh, yes.
How
it took ages.
So how did you go about it?
Well, they all had to be reclassified.
Because it must have been quite a long time when you must have had both systems going.
Yeah. We worked really hard on that. We did take the British National Bibliography. Now, the BNB was in classified order Dewey. So that had been a help. Over the years, we'd used some class numbers from the BNB to help us in the interloan of books, because of course the library borrowing our books used Dewey. And if we wanted to borrow, we were on Brown and they used Dewey.
So can you just take me through, you know, not knowing how libraries work, how the classification actually works, kind of the Dewey.
Well, the Dewey scheme is it's a decimal scheme, therefore there are 10 classes in Dewey, 10 subject classes. Again, a bit unusual in that English language and English literature are divided for some reason. For I think it's 400 class is language and 800 classes literature. And so you assign a number to a book, and that number has to be in some way or other indicated on the spine of the book. And so you put your books in order by the various numbers. Now, if you put them with Dewey, put them in order by number, you're then automatically putting them in order by subject. This is non-fiction, forgetting fiction. Fiction usually do alphabetical by author. And that's the way it's done. But it's a long time since I did it. Because I had it about 10 years. I was cheap and I wasn't doing it.
So in the fiction library then, all books would be alphabetical no matter what subject they were, because nowadays they seem to be divided up, don't they?
Yeah, you always have this argument as to whether you should try a scheme of fiction classification in a way. Westerns, thrillers, general, you know, that kind of thing. And other people said, no, you shouldn't do it like that, you should have it just alphabetical by author. Generally speaking, it's alphabetical by author that I worked with. And yet, when I go into Razzleton Library, yes, you see the thrillers and the separated.
So as a young man, sort of 17, when you started work at the library, what was the natural progression through the library service?
Well, as long as you were qualifying, and I went, I qualified right through to fellowship.
So would this entail sort of out of work?
Yes, this was day release. The general way of doing it when I took my exams was day release. And I used to go to classes.
Where would that
be? In Manchester. Quite often. They're always moving around, the library school at Manchester. But UMIST was the one I started at. It used to be the Manchester College of Technology. It was UMIST. And they had classes there. And then you took an exam called the entrance exam. Fair enough. That means you could go then on to the professional exams. And all this has changed, but this is the way I did it. And we took a registration exam, it was called. And when you passed that, it was in so many subjects. That means you could go then on to the professional exams. And all this has changed, but this is the way I did it. And we took a registration exam, it was called. And when you passed that, it was in so many subjects. When you passed that, you became a chartered librarian. And if you wanted to enhance that, you then took the fellowship. And at one time, if you were seeing yourself becoming a chief, then you took the fellowship.
You said you were taking these classes in several different subjects. What sort of subject areas would it cover?
In the entrance one, that was pretty basic. You'd have to write an essay. And that was to see, whether you were suitable for libraries. The registration exam, you took classification, cataloguing, administration. We didn't do a book selection at that. That came later. English, we did. Now, believe this, we did it. It was only just one term, really. We did the history of English literature from Chaucer to the present day.
In one term?
In one term. We had a very good tutor. He'd been doing it for years. He wasn't a librarian, he was an English master. And he used to say, right, I think the following subjects will come up this time because they haven't come up for years, you know. Most of us got through in the years. And then the fellowship. You took classification cataloguing at more advanced level, book selection, administration of libraries, various.
When you say book selection, that's looking at to get what books to take into the library.
Yeah. Yeah. And for quite a while, I got the job. My old boss gave me the job. Was it the fiction? Book selection of all the fiction books. And then I went on to non-fiction.
The classes and your training and qualification, did you have to fund that yourself? Was it?
Yes. Yeah.
You wouldn't be able to apply for any grants or any help?
Well, you could. I got a grant at Burnley. When I moved over to Burnley, I was taking classification cataloguing at registration level. And I was working in Burnley and going to classes in Manchester that time. And it cost me a little bit. And I got a grant from Burnley Council. But because I left within 2 years or something like that, I had to pay it back. we funded ourselves, really.
So within the library service at that time, was the promotion, was it sort of a natural progression, or was it sort of dead man's shoes, or would you have to apply? Were jobs advertised?
I was lucky. I was very lucky. The right place at the right time. The original was the junior job when I left school, and then I took the entrance exam, which allowed me to go on to the registration exam, which I took. And eventually passed. It was in so many parts, so it took a few years. And this job at Burnley was advertised. Now, I was senior assistant at that time. It was a Burnley lad, and he'd worked there. And he said, "You ought to go there. It's quite a good library service." So I applied for it, and I got it. And used to travel every day. I didn't have a car then. Over to Burnley. I was there a couple of years. 1955 to 1957, and I don't know whether I was wrong or not, but I was a bit miffed when I passed my registration exam, became an associate of the Library Association. I was told I had to go out to one of the branches at Burnley. I was travelling a fair distance from Ramsbottom to Burnley. This would have been an extra journey, and this was so that I could get the pay for being a chartered librarian. But he'd granted this pay, I'm the chief librarian, to other members of staff without them having voted. I was a bit miffed. And this job for reference librarian came up at Bury, you see, and I knew Bury very well, of course. And I applied for that and got it. And the rest of my career was spent at Bury. I was reference librarian and then lending librarian and deputy Bury librarian, and then reorganisation came. And I was in charge of bibliographical services for a time. And then another job came up, general services, which was a bit of a promotion. And eventually chief librarian and arts officer, which I did for about 10 years. So that was my progress. It wasn't everybody's, but that was mine. I didn't leave. Really, I didn't leave Bury. The 2 years I did at Burnley, I was always popping into Bury Library saying, "Oh, getting on, you know, we both in Bury."
You said something a moment ago that I'd be quite interested in. When you were arranging the fiction books to come into the library, how would you go about choosing which books you would take into the library for the shelves?
Well, we dealt with booksellers, of course. A little bit with your local bookseller, but there were specialist booksellers for libraries. And they used to come along, bring all the information they had on new books. That on the fiction side. And it's an art as much as a science. You look at it and think, well, that won't go down very well here in Bury, and that will go down. And the council might ban that or whatever.
And would that work the same way for the non-fiction?
Non-fiction was a bit different. The chief did it for quite a time. And the 10 years I did as chief, we had a bid services officer, as we call it, and he did the book selection. He was in charge of both fiction and non-fiction. Non-fiction, of course, is, well, you've got to look at them and see whether there's a gap in your present allocation of books. And that, I think, was probably more interesting than doing the fiction. But my old boss used to keep that to himself, and only got that after he retired.
The years that you worked at Bury Library, did things change very much in how things run?
Oh, yes. Yes, it became more professional.
In what way?
Well, when I started work there, the only qualified librarian was the chief librarian, the deputy. They were the only ones qualified. The rest were they'd worked there or they were taking the exams. Whereas later on, we had the qualified chief, deputy, reference librarian, lending librarian, a music librarian, children's librarian, so we have more professional. They've cut down on them there, but I think they're wrong. But that was one of the biggest changes. And we tried to modernise the library because the use of libraries rather changed during my time. You know, when I started work, one morning a week, you were on papers. So you had to come a quarter of an hour early to put up all the daily and weekly newspapers that were bought in a very large reading room, well, comparatively large reading room, and we looked at that in comparison to the lending library. Because you used to take all kinds of newspapers in those days. And we eventually took over that room for lending and had a smaller space for newspapers, and more and more people started having the newspaper delivered, or we weren't all that interested in the Preston Guardian in Ramsbottom, Bury. But we used to take 2 Manchester Guardians, about 3 or 4 Bury Times, and so on. And you used to put them on, there were slopes, reading slopes, and you had a little key and a brass rod, and you used to put them in, and people used to stand up and read the papers. Well, that was a big change. Troubled people, anyway, who hated the idea of not being able to have to read the newspaper.
You always have this picture of the person who's nowhere else to go, spending the days in the libraries and the reading. But was there ever any problems in that respect?
Yes, there were at times, it could be difficult. We had in Bury, in my day, quite a few doss houses. We knew when they'd been turfed out, the residents. They all came in the library. And sometimes it got a bit smelly, to say the least. It's very sad looking back, but it wasn't all that funny at the time. And someone came and said, "That chap over there has been delousing himself for ages." But, I think libraries have changed.
But you would leave them there, would you, or would you have to ask them to leave?
It depended. If they were behaving themselves, we'd leave them there. Sometimes they wouldn't.
But the actual method of issuing a book and retrieving it when it returned, that remained the same, did it?
Not at Bury. We had what they called a... My mind is going. A token system, that was it. It was a plastic token system. It was introduced in Westminster. And with the token system, you know, a plastic token, and it didn't have anybody's name or anything on it. You were allowed four, I think. And at the end of 12 months, you had to bring in these four tokens, because when somebody took a book out, we took a token from them. Now, this was put in 1965 because the Brown system was creaking. It wasn't doing its job.
Was this, why? Was this the numbers?
It got busier, yes. The place got busier, particularly at weekends. And, people queuing down the steps of the library. So we had this token system. So it was in one or two places. And it meant it was very fast. Westminster Library was extremely busy at lunch times because people who were working in Westminster were allowed to join the library. But they were working during the day and they used to go, everybody went to the library at lunchtime, you see. So they had to have something. They've got an R&M people to devise this token system. And we put it in at Burnley while I was working there, and then we put it in at Bury. It was supposed to be a temporary measure until computers came, but it was in about 20 years.
So how would it actually work? You know, somebody had a token.
It doesn't work really. It's a code.
Right, because I'm thinking, how would you know who had actually borrowed that book?
We didn't. We knew they'd got a book, but we didn't know which book it was. And it was a bit of a, you tried to get people to use it properly. On the whole, I suppose they did. But at that time, if there had been a computer system, we would have done that. But there wasn't. There wasn't a computer system designed for libraries at that time. So
that came in after you...
after I'd gone back to Bury in 1965. And it was there in 1990 when I retired. But it's changed now. Of course, they're not all computers, which... We tried to get them to the computers, and okay, but Bury never. Perhaps they said, we're not letting Bury have any money, I don't know. But
they perhaps thought it was so efficient as it was.
Oh, that, well, they would think that if they wanted to think that, of course.
Just leaving the libraries just for a moment and thinking back at Ramsbottom, over the years that you've lived here, I mean, you've lived here a long time, how has it changed?
Oh, tremendously. Tremendously. People think it hasn't changed because the shops down at Ramsbottom Centre are still there from the 1830s. But when I was a kid here, if you went to the top of Holcombe Hill, you could hardly see Ramsbottom. No way could you see. As you can today, the everything is all right, you can see Snowdonia. And you couldn't even see Ramsbottom, because there are 24 mills in Ramsbottom, all belching out smoke. That's one of the biggest changes. It was a small industrial town. More or less, not, I'd say, founded, but developed in the late 18th century. But now it would appear to be a dormitory town for Manchester. That's the biggest change. It isn't really an industrial town anymore. And I can still remember hearing, where I lived, down one side of the street were houses. I really lived in one. The other side of the street were cotton mills. And I can still hear the clogs clattering down to the mills at about 7:15 in the morning, something like that, to start work at 7:30. So yes, it was very much an industrial place.
And what about the amenities? How have they changed over the years?
In some ways, they're not as good. In some ways, you haven't got the same number. I don't think any grocery shops, except the two supermarkets. Things like that have changed. We had our own bus service, which was a very good one. It was one of the smallest bus services in the country. It was Ramsbottom UDC. That was a very good service. You know, it made a profit too. And other amenities, well, there are one or two extra schools. We have a civic hall that we didn't used to have at one time. That what used to be a conservative club, and it was given as a civic hall to the council. So and that is okay.
What about the cinemas? Do they remain?
No, they've gone. The cinemas went. We have a theatre. In one of the cinemas is now a theatre. It's an amateur theatre, and it's a very good one. They rent the Sun Sea Players. It's excellent. And
what about public transport? Is that still...
Public transport is excellent during the day. It's not as good in the evenings and on Sundays. But during the weekdays, we've had very good service into Bury and into Manchester.
This is the bus?
This is by bus. Mm-hmm. And of course, if you go by bus into Bury, you can get on the Metrolink. So that's a bit of an extension. And I don't know about the East Lancashire Railway. It's an amenity, I suppose. It's a bit expensive. And it only runs at weekends and during holiday, bank holidays and so on. But it's there. And a lot of people use it.
But now you find that a lot of people have moved in.
Oh, yes.
As that are working in the bigger cities.
Yeah.
In the bigger towns.
Yes, the development, the housing development has been tremendous in Ramsbottom. We still keep our town centre with its tilted urn. Nobody wanted. I suppose I've got used to it.
Every town's got one.
Yes. So, other amenities, well, I don't know. You're okay if you want supermarkets. A lot of the other shops, as I said, they come and go.
Well, unless you think I've missed anything out,
no.
I think I've covered all I wanted to ask you.
Well, good.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you.